want to publicly thank Lloyd Atkinson for taking over for me last week. For some of you, I think somebody asked Barbara where I was last Sunday, and her answer was, I have no idea.
No, she said somewhere going towards South Dakota, I think.
Yeah. We went a little over 4,000 miles in 9 days. We made it to North and South Dakota and Nebraska. We wanted to make it to Montana, but decided that just wasn't practical. We saw places where floods had been. We saw places where tornadoes had hit. We saw lots and lots and lots of farmland. Okay, we have been looking for a number of weeks at the Ten Commandments, at the context for that, and the consequences of that, and we are now ready to move beyond that. So if you can find in your Bible Exodus 20. My plan is to give you a sense of the lay of the land for the next several chapters, and then go back and dig into specific and particular places within them. So if you take a look at chapter 20, verse 1, God spoke all these words, and the words that God spoke were the Ten Commandments. Verse 18, my translation has four ing words in a row with modifiers for each one. Seeing the thunder pealing, the lightning flashing, the trumpet blasting, and the mountain smoking, the people were all terrified. Speak to us yourself, they said to Moses, and we will obey, but don't let God speak to us or we will die. What they were essentially saying was, Moses, you go talk to God. Find out what God wants. You come back and tell us. We don't want to hear God talk anymore. If we hear God's voice again, we're going to die. And starting in chapter 20, verse 22, Moses begins a conversation with God. Presumably, he has gone up the mountain. You can see verse 21. The people kept their distance while Moses approached the dark cloud where God was. That was up the mountain. The rest of chapter 20, verses 21, 22, and 23, is the conversation that Moses had with God. I've said conversation. I could have said dialogue, but that would probably be, in both cases, misleading. If you look in verse 22, the Lord said to Moses, comma, quotation mark, and then words appear. Is that the way yours is laid out? Okay. My translation sets things up by paragraph, not by verse. Every paragraph begins with another quotation mark, all the way through chapter 23. So this isn't a dialogue in the sense of Moses and God both speaking, at least according to what's recorded. I have confidence that Moses was speaking, but the Bible doesn't record it. So what you see is God's words to Moses. When chapter 23 ends, the first two verses of chapter 24 are God's final instructions to Moses in this first conversation. He said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you, and then he names three people, and then he identifies 70 elders of Israel. And you have the picture then that at that point, that first conversation was ended. Moses goes down to the people and begins to tell them what God has said. And that's in fact what it says. Verse 3, Moses went and told the people all of God's words and all of God's laws. So far, okay? Okay. That begins, chapter 24, verse 3, begins an interlude. At the end of that interlude, which is the last two verses of chapter 24, verse 18, Moses went back to the Lord for another conversation. In this conversation as well, you only hear what God is saying. You don't hear Moses' replies or conversation in return. And that conversation takes place all the way through chapter 31. So far, okay? All right, last verse of chapter 24, Moses went right into the cloud and went on up the mountain. How long did he stay on the mountain?
40 days
and 40 nights. So the conversation that begins, chapter 25, the Lord spoke to Moses and said, quotation mark, and here you go again. Every paragraph has another quotation mark, and this keeps going all the way through chapter 31. Chapter 32, some things happen again. So here's the lay of the land. The Ten Commandments have been spoken by God. The people have said, that can't ever happen again. If we hear God's voice again, we're all going to die. You go find out what God wants. Come back and tell us, and we'll do it. Moses goes up on the mountain, has the first conversation. He comes back down. There's an interlude. He goes back up the mountain for how long? 40 days, 40 nights. Comes back down. Chapter 32, there's some things that happen there. That's the layout. Okay? Now, what I want to do first is I want to talk with you just a little bit about what happens in that interlude and what happens at the end. I want to talk a little bit about the context and the content, very generally, of the first conversation and the content of the second conversation. And then I want to see if I can put all that together where you'll walk out this morning with a sense of sort of how the flow happens. We're then, with whatever time we have left, going to go back into the first conversation and begin to look at details in there, some things that you need to make sure you walk away remembering. So far, all right? Okay. Now, number one, I want you to look at the interlude. Verse 3, chapter 24. Moses went, presumably down the mountain, and told the people all of God's words and all of God's laws. If he tells the people all of God's words, what's he giving them? This isn't hard, just work with me. The Ten Commandments. If he gives them all of God's laws, what's he giving them? The first conversation. Second conversation hasn't taken place yet. So it's God's words, that's the Ten Commandments, and then this first collection of laws and instructions that's taking place in the conversation in the tail end of 20, 21, 22, 23, in those chapters. Have you read all that? Good. First hour, I had a whole bunch of people who said no. Sounds like maybe a few of you are doing a little bit better than that. If you haven't read it yet, what I hope is at the end of the day, you'll have some context to go back and you'll know a little bit better how to read this. Okay? So, he has read to them, Moses went and told the people all of the Lord's words and all the Lord's laws. The words were the Ten Commandments. Presumably, the laws were the subject of the first conversation. What did he do next? Well, I'm sorry, the rest of verse 3 tells the response of the people. What was the people's response? We'll do it. Verse 4, what did Moses do? Wrote it all down. Verse 5, what did he do?
Built an altar.
Verse 6, what did he do? Actually, maybe still verse 5. Verse 4 was building the altar. Verse 5, what did he do? Yeah, who did the burnt offerings? Mine says certain young people from Israel. We honored the high school graduates today. Maybe it was some of those for that year. I don't know. What did they do? They offered burnt offerings and sacrificed bull to the Lord. Moses then took the blood. What did he do with it? Put half of it in the basins. What did he do with the other half? Sprinkle the altar. Verse 7. What does he do? He takes a book. What book? It tells you the name of the book.
Book of the Covenant.
Book of the Covenant. Okay. What's the Book of the Covenant? Verse 4. What did he do in verse 4? What did he write down? Verse 3. God's words and God's laws. What were God's words? Ten Commandments. What was God's law? It was that first conversation. So, he tells the people, and what do the people say?
We'll do it all.
He then writes it down. That's now the Book of the Covenant. That's the beginning of what we have for this part of the Bible. Just a little part. Writes that down. And what does he do in verse 7?
Reads
the... So, they've already heard God's words from God himself. Now they've heard God's words repeated, and they've heard the essence of the conversation he's had with God. And the people said... We'll do it all. He then writes it all down, and then he reads it to them a second time, and what do they do? We will do everything the Lord has said, semicolon, we will obey. And what does he do now? He sprinkles the rest of the blood on the people. What's just happened? What was this book called? Book of the Covenant. We have just had a covenant made. Twice the people have affirmed their agreement to the covenant. And now after the second affirmation, he has sealed it by sprinkling blood from the sacrifice on them. Everybody okay? And just in case you didn't know this, Moses says, this is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you, entailing all of these stipulations. You have to go to law school to learn the word stipulations, but there it is. All right? Now, back up to chapter 24, verse 1. What were Moses' instructions from God? The very last instructions he got in that long conversation. Come up, or maybe come back up to the Lord, and when you do, bring some people with you. Who are you supposed to bring? 3 named people and 70 unnamed people, and these 73 people constitute what? The leaders, the elders, the people who were the notables, my translation says at one point. And what are they supposed to do? Come up to the Lord, that's verse 1 of chapter 24. Come up to the Lord, and at a distance. Yeah. Now what's going on here? The leaders of the people are being allowed to see what Moses saw in the mountaintop. They're not allowed to approach God as far as Moses did, but they're being allowed to see what Moses saw. Verse 9, what did they see? Because that's what verse 9 is. I think it's verse 9, chapter 24, verse 9. No, verse 9, they went up.
Yeah.
Right? I'm saying verse 9 is all this fulfilled. Who went up? Moses and the three who were named, including Aaron, number 1, and the 70 elders of Israel, mine says, they went up. Verse 10, what did they see? And what did they see? They saw beneath whose feet there was what looked like a sapphire pavement as pure as the heavens themselves. But he, that is God, did no harm to the notables of Israel, and they ate and drank in the presence of God. I want to make sure you hear what they just said. Have I succeeded?
Mm-hmm. Did they just say bacon?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, I don't know.
The power of chapter 33 has to be in light of these two verses. They have been given not just a glimpse. They got long enough to eat a meal. They gazed on God, my translation says. What do you think that felt like? To gaze on God. Just as Moses had. Except for hearing God speak some more, they've gotten everything Moses got. And when this little piece is over, what happens? The implication is they went back down, and Moses and his servant Joshua went back up. And how long was Moses gone? We've already read it. 40 days and 40 nights, during which the second conversation took place. So when they come back down in chapter 32, how long has it been? 40 days and 40 nights. A lot of other things in the Bible took 40 days and 40 nights. Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, the flood, lots of other things took 40 days and 40 nights. Okay. By the time they come back down, what's happened? They're all worshiping false idols. A golden statue of a calf has been set up, and all the people are worshiping it. And they're worshiping it in ways that are offensive. How long did that take? 40 days and 40 nights. What had the elders of the people, including Aaron as number 1, had just before those 40 days and 40 nights started? The chance to look on God, to gaze at God. And 40 days later, something has happened, and in that time period, the people have said, where'd Moses go? And the elders have said, don't have a clue. Where's God? Who's that? We need a God. Well, let's make a God. Let's throw some gold in the furnace and see what comes out. Here's a calf. Let's all worship it. 40 days is all it took. There's a message hiding in there, folks. God can give you the deepest insight you have ever seen in your life. And it can wear off just as quickly.
How many, all the Israelites
in this first part, when they received the Ten Commandments, how many were there that all?
Some estimates are as high as a million, maybe 1,200,000 is the upper limit of the estimates I've heard.
They were all there.
And the leaders, 73 of the leaders have gotten a little bit closer. I wonder why it's not 72. The Bible likes 72, but somehow there were 73. It's Aaron and 72 others. Somehow Aaron. And who put the gold in the furnace for the calf to come out? I'm assuming you've read chapter 32. This was your assignment before you left us, right? Aaron put the gold in heaven. Aaron, Moses' brother, who had the chance to look on God within 40 days. It's Moses. Where's he gone? I don't know. We need a God. Let's make one. What was the number one commandment of the Ten Commandments? Don't worship any other gods. What's number two? Don't make any idols. What'd they do? They broke the first two. Now, how did this happen? It happened because they're human beings. Now, that's the overarching thing. You got a conversation, and we're going to come back now and look at some details in that. And then you have this interlude. And this interlude is borders on the unbelievable. And then you have another conversation. So here's Moses with God getting instructions of worship here. And here's the people debasing everything that's there. Led by the very leaders that God had said, I'll give you a chance to look at me without dying. How did that happen? Answer, happens all the time. Happens all the time. What was the message about in the worship service today?
Elijah.
First hour, I had half the group hadn't even been there. So that, today, this should be a little bit better. What was the subject?
Elijah opened my eyes that I might see.
It wasn't Elijah, it was Elisha, right? Okay, well, let's work on this for a minute. How many books of the law in the Old Testament?
Five.
How many books of history?
12.
How many books of the wisdom literature? 5. How many books of the prophets? 17. 5 plus 12. The 5 are called major prophets, and the 12 are called minor prophets. The 12 minor prophets are called minor prophets because they're unimportant, right? Of course not. They're called minor prophets because who lives? The major prophets are called major prophets because they're big and important, right? No, it's because big books. Who's the most significant and important prophets? Moses and Elijah. Okay? Does Elijah have a book? No. So, you know, major prophets, minor prophets, just make sure you don't get hung on that word to think. So, here's Elijah. And the pastor this morning gave you a sense of how significant Elijah was. Okay? Who was Elisha first? Not later. First. He was Elijah's servant. Okay. Let me take a second, make sure you know American history. If you go to the Lincoln Monument, there's a statue of a president inside of the Lincoln Monument. Who's the president?
Lincoln.
Very good. I sort of thought you could get that one. Very good. Okay. What was Lincoln's profession prior to going into politics? He was a lawyer. What law school did he graduate from?
No, he didn't.
How did he become a lawyer?
Red.
Nope. That's half of it. He was an apprentice to a working lawyer. What was Elisha? He was an apprentice to Elijah. We use the word servant, and you misunderstand if you think that means somebody who made his meals and fixed his clothes. This was his apprentice. They don't use that word, but that might be a better word to use. If you've watched enough Star Wars, you might want to say Padawan learner, but you know, maybe that doesn't work.
Well, we got to see Raiders.
I know you did. As soon as he told us about that, I knew you were going to get to see that little part. Okay. But he's an apprentice, right? And when Elijah goes, who becomes the prophet? Elisha has now finished his apprenticeship and he becomes a prophet. Everybody okay? Right? What were, maybe not the very last, but the almost the last words that Elisha said to Elijah? Elisha said, I want a double portion of your spirit. And Elijah says, I don't know if you're going to get that, but I'm going to go in a pretty spectacular way. And if you see me go, you'll have a double portion of my spirit. And Elisha saw him go. And his cloak, his mantle, the one the pastor talked about, fell from the chariot as he left. Elisha picked up the cloak and walked away with a double portion of Elijah's spirit. Depends on how you count it, but most people who count... Did the pastor talk with you about the periods of time in which miracles are prominent in the Bible? One of those is the Elijah-Elisha period, right? Okay. How many miracles are attributed to Elijah? Do you know? It's not really important that you know, but the number, most people, if you go through and count, most people, the number's 8. How many for Elisha?
16.
Why? Because he had a double portion. Okay. What did you have for breakfast? You, right here, back room. What did you have today?
A double
portion of breakfast. That's what you had. I decided I wouldn't comment on it during their opening time. I thought I'd wait till right now. That's what you had. Double portions, good, right? Double portions, impressive. Elisha had a double portion of Elijah's spirit. This is a powerful, powerful prophet. So who was Elisha's apprentice?
Gehazi.
G-E-H-A-Z-I, I think. Okay? God was telling Elisha everything the army of Aram was doing. He was passing that on to the king of Israel. Every time Aram tried to make a move, he was thwarted because of the word that came. The king of Aram said, we're going to wipe that guy out. He sent an army. He surrounded. Pastor talked about that this morning, right?
Yep.
Pastor talked about this. Who's first one up?
Gehazi.
The servant of, which we now know means the apprentice of, the prophet in waiting, Gehazi. And what does Gehazi say? My father, what are we going to do? How many prayers did Elisha pray at that point? Aha! You don't know. 2. Pastor only talked to you about the first one. What was the first prayer? Open his eyes. Whose eyes? Gehazi's eyes. So he could see what? So he could see the army surrounding the house. And that was an army of chariots of fire and horses of fire. Right? Open his eyes. So he, what was the second prayer? The second prayer was, God, take away the sight from all the army that surrounds the house. They were all blinded. It wasn't time this morning for the pastor to tell you that part. By the time their eyes were allowed to open again, they were all lined up and surrounded by the army of Israel. And what did Elisha do then? Gave them lunch and sent them home. And the army of Aram was a problem after that. Open the eyes of this one. Blind the eyes of that one. God responded. Put yourself in Gehazi's position. What have you now seen? Miracle after miracle after miracle that God is doing through your master Elisha. And the big one comes. That wasn't the big one. The big one comes when Naaman is cured of leprosy. I'm drawing a parallel for you. Can you put it together? What happened back in Exodus? The people were given, their eyes were opened to see a spiritual reality that transcended anything they could see. And within 40 days, they're acting like they knew nothing about it. And they're just dropping the ball like crazy. Here's Gehazi, who has had his eyes open to a spiritual reality he knew nothing about. And within a very short time. I'd be willing to bet, the Bible doesn't help us here, it probably was 40 days from the time he had that vision until Naaman was healed and he had this great fall. We've talked about Gehazi on another day. We don't need to do it now. But Gehazi completely collapsed in his potential for leadership. He got greedy for things the world had. And it was like he had never seen all the things that Elisha had allowed him to see. Don't look at Gehazi as a servant. Look at him as an apprentice prophet who fails his job. Here's the leaders of Israel, the elders of Israel, failing their job. That's the big overarching story. You got that? Okay, so we can now go back and look at the two conversations, right? Conversation number one. Conversation number one. This is the one that starts at the end of 20 and goes through the first couple of verses of 24. I don't know if you have a modern Bible. I don't know if you have a Bible that has sections. Mine does, and it's got little headings for each section. What's the first thing that happens in this? Start at chapter 20, verse 22. God repeats the injunction, no idols, especially no idols of silver or gold. What's the sin in chapter 32? They made an idol of gold. What did the people say? We will obey. We'll do everything he said. What was the number one thing God said? No idols, especially no idols of gold. It's amazing. 24, you must make me an altar of earth on which to sacrifice your burnt offerings and communion sacrifices. Wherever I choose to have my name remembered, I will come to you and bless you. Where are you allowed to set up an altar? Any place God chooses. Later on, this one gets narrowed. People are told the place to worship is Jerusalem in the temple. People are told the place to worship is Jerusalem and the temple. Don't just set up worship points anywhere you want. But for the moment, God says, I'm going to bless worship places in a number of places. He does say, don't do it with dressed stones. Don't put a chisel to the stone to make the stone pretty. Okay? That's the first one. There's 13 of these before you get to the little interlude that we talked about. The second section, starting in chapter 21, verse 1, talks about slavery. Talks about periods of slavery and so forth. Starting at chapter 21, verse 12, it talks about people dying by the hand of other people, either by deliberate murder or by accident. The fourth one starts at verse 18, and it talks about assaults and wounds and injuries. I think it's the first verse of 22, starts one that talks about the theft of animals. And that's followed by, in around verse 5 of chapter 22, when there's economic consequences from activities involving animals. If your animal goes and does something to somebody else, or you've borrowed somebody's animal and something happens to that animal while the animal's in your care, what do you do about that? Okay. There's a very strange one that I'm not sure I want to stay with very long in verse 16 and 17 that talks about what happens when virgins are molested. And then in verse 18, I think it is, he finally turns back to attitudes that have to do with morals and with religion. He talks about verse 19 or verse 20, anyone who sacrifices to other gods will be put under the curse of destruction. Talks about not molesting or oppressing aliens or widows or orphans, not economically taking advantage of the poor. Verse 28 starts talking about offerings and begins to talk about firstborn and first fruits. We're going to come back in a moment, look at details of this. I'm just trying to outline this for you. Chapter 23, verse 1 begins to talk about justice and duties towards others, especially towards people that you don't like or that don't like you. Verse 10 and 11, this is still in chapter 23, 10 and 11, begin a section that talks about the Sabbath. The Sabbath for people was how often? One day out of seven. What's the sabbatical for year, for land? 1 year out of 7 years. You let the land go fallow for 1 year out of seven. People who understand agriculture say it's good to rotate the crops, have different kinds of things growing, and it's good to let the land rest. The instructions are way back here, although where those came from Well, Leviticus is coming with details on. Almost all of these are fleshed out more when you get to Leviticus. Verse 14 and 15 begin a section that talks about three great feast days during the year. Talks again a little bit about first fruits. And then finally, starting in chapter 23, verse 20, and going to the rest of that chapter, it talks about things that are going to happen when the people enter the promised land. 13 sections in here, roughly, and there's some artificiality about that division. The bulk of the first half is talking about interactions between people. I'll tell you that people who are critics of Christianity, people who are ones who do not believe the Bible has anything of substance to say, this is one of the places they will go to find things to throw back in your face. You need to be aware of that. The pastor said in our hour that there was a section about Elisha, that he didn't understand. You remember that one? Some I don't understand too. And people will use those. I'm going to talk about one of those before the hour is out if I can. But there's the thrust of the first conversation. Now I want to go back now and look at some very specific things with you for just a moment. If you'll come back to chapter 21, verse 2. There seems to be a distinction. I don't know that I understand the distinction between a slave who is an Israelite and a slave who is not an Israelite. Do you pick that up in verse 2 of chapter 21? When you buy a Hebrew slave, how long does his service last?
6 years.
In the seventh year, what happens? He goes free. There's a sabbatical for slaves, except it's a permanent sabbatical. It's not 1 year out of seven. It's 6 years, and then that's done. It gives some details that I don't know that I understand all that well, but there it is. Chapter 21, look at verse 23 and 24. This is in the middle of the section on blows and wounds. Up until the time this was given, there were some parallel laws being given in other places. The Code of Hammurabi supposedly has some things parallel to this. Up until this time, if somebody injured you, what was the usual response of revenge? You'd kill them. This is leveling that out. And if you look in here, it says, if further harm is done, however, you will award. And mine has eight things. The first one is life for life. And then seven more past that. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, and stroke for stroke. Somebody stumbles and kicks you in the shins, you don't get to punch out their eye. What do you get to do?
Kick them
in the shin. I still think there might be, from my perspective, from the perspective of this side of the New Testament, there might be better ways to deal with it. But back here, it's leveling it out. Proportional response. Okay? I need you to look at chapter 22, verse 28. Chapter 22, verse 28. I checked in the first hour, and nobody's translation agreed with mine. That happens sometimes. But I like what I see in mind because it resonates with some things in the New Testament. And I want to make sure you see this as well. Chapter 22, verse 28. This is the first verse of a little section, the focus of which is firstborn and first fruits. But it begins with a focus on offerings. Mine says, do not be slow about making offerings. Now, I was told the first hour that what mine says is verse 28 is your verse 29. So you might look at one verse beyond where you are. Is yours verse 29 that parallels that? Do not be slow about making offerings. And then mine has about five or six more words. And those five or six more words I think are very, very, very important. Here's what mine says. Do not be slow about making offerings from your abundance, from your surplus. Yours just says from your granaries or from your vats or something like that, right? It doesn't capture the spirit of an overflow.
The ESV does.
Does it?
Yeah, it says, you shall not delay to offer from the fullness of your harvest.
From the fullness.
From the outflow of your presses.
From the outflow. The idea of the surplus, that hits. It either hits with 1st or 2nd Corinthians. I didn't go look it up, and I'm not going to look it up now. It's chapter 8, I think, but it's one of those two. It says, here's the way it's supposed to work. You give what you can to relieve the problems and needs of other people from the surplus God has given you. And when you come into need, they will give to support your needs from their surplus. That's the way balance is supposed to take place. It says in that part in 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians, you're not supposed to give to where you go into poverty. You're supposed to give from what God has given you, from the surplus, from the abundance. And there's a real good correlation between these two, and I want to make sure you see that as we go by. Because I think it's talking about the same thing. Now, it immediately goes into first fruits and firstborn. Look at verse, it'll probably be your verse 30. You will give me the firstborn of your children. You will give me the firstborn of your children. You will do the same with your flocks and herds. For the first 7 days, the firstborn will stay with its mother. On the 8th day, you will give it to me. What happened with Jesus when he was born? What happened 8 days out? He was taken to the temple. Why? To fulfill this law. To fulfill this instruction. This is not the only place you find it. There's echoes in Leviticus and other places as well. But it says, on the 8th day, you give the child to me. Okay? When Hannah had Samuel, she kept Samuel for 2 or 3 years and then came and fulfilled this. So she delayed.
But did she not promise?
He did. Okay. Now, what I want you to do is I want you to jump over. Don't lose your place because we're going to come back to that. But jump over to Exodus 34. I didn't do this in the first hour, but let me do this for you. Take a look at Exodus 34, verse 10. God says, I'm making a covenant. And then he comes down to verse 17. You will not cast metal gods for yourselves. Verse 18, you will observe the feast of unleavened bread. If you look at what's in 17, 18, 19, 20, it's sort of a summary of that first conversation way back here. If you look at chapter 34 of Exodus, it's almost like there's a summary of some things that were said in that first part. Okay? And you'll see others as we get further into the details of this. But here's what I want you to see. Verse 19 of Exodus 34. It's a fleshing out of what you just saw. And here's what it says. All that first issues from the womb belongs to me. If somebody has 17 children, who's the firstborn? This is not hard, guys. Don't go silent. The first of the 17. This is what you do for the first one. You've got an animal. The first time the animal gives birth to an offspring, that one and only that one is covered by this. Everybody okay? All that first issues from the womb belongs to me. Every male, every firstborn of flock or herd. But the firstborn donkey, what happens? Redeem it. Mine says with another animal from the flock. I think yours may say with a lamb or something like that. Is that right? If you do not redeem it, it must die. Last sentence of verse 20. All the firstborn of your sons you will redeem. Okay? How many firstborns are there? How many women are bearing children? The first child, born to each woman, that's the firstborn. What do you do? You redeem. And no one appears before me empty-handed. You get to Leviticus and it says, here's what you do. You sacrifice it. I believe it's either a ram or a bull. And then it says, but if you can't afford that, you can come before me with two turtle doves. With two doves. What did Mary and Joseph bring to the temple on the 8th day? Two doves. What does that tell you? They were poor. That's your clue that they were poor. The idea of redemption comes really early. Firstborn belongs to God, but they can be redeemed. They don't have to die. And that's true for donkeys, and that's true for people.
Okay. May I ask why donkeys, and it doesn't refer to daughters? And
I have no idea. I'm bothered by a number.
Does it show the correlation when they say sons? Does that mean sons and daughters? I would assume it means sons.
I'm pretty sure in those days it meant son.
So what happens? And when it says,
it's silent
Lord,
on that.
Is that kind of like when you dedicate our kids to the Lord, or is that's not a sacrifice?
The picture early was, I think, an echo of child sacrifice in cultures around them. I think that it's an echo of child sacrifice in cultures around them. I think you see it coming later with Abraham and Isaac. There was child sacrifice in the cultures around them. Right? Abraham, way back, had offered Isaac. What happened with Isaac? He was redeemed. And I think it's an echo of Abraham and Isaac that's coming in here. The absence of reference to daughters, I think, is because of the gender nature of this, that they weren't noticed the way they should have been. But the picture I want you to see is this. The idea... No, that's what he's saying. There will not be a killing of the firstborn, but there will be a recognition that the firstborn belongs to me, and an act of redemption, and you will not come before me empty-handed to do that. Even the poor must bring a little.
And that, have no idea what the donkey thing is.
I suspect there's...
Donkeys can't reproduce, or is it mules?
Mules can't. Donkeys can't. I don't know the reference to donkeys. I find it fascinating, and I'm sure there's a reason, but I don't know what it is. Yeah, I don't know why that animal is singled out. Okay. Okay.
Because they maybe it was such a work, they needed it for work, so
it seems to be elevating the donkey to something approaching the level of sons, which means it may surpass daughters. I don't know. I don't. Donkey. That was supposed to be funny, and I doubt it was. That was supposed to be funny, but I don't think it was. There's something happening with donkeys that I don't understand.
I just didn't know that history, if you knew.
Yeah. Okay, back to chapter 22.
The donkey is elevated in status by Jesus riding on the donkey.
Hey!
Yeah. Take a look at chapter 22, start at verse 20, and look through at least verse 26. What you find here, remember this was the section that began to talk about morals again. The big part of this is, don't molest or oppress aliens living among you, for you were once aliens. Don't oppress the widows. Don't oppress the orphans, or you might find your own wives and children becoming widows and orphans. Don't oppress the poor by taking from them interest that would break their backs economically. And if they have to give you something that is vital to their livelihood, like a cloak, as a pledge of some loan you're giving to them, give them the cloak back every night, because otherwise they can't stay warm through the night. God's saying, I notice what happens with the poor. I notice what happens with the widows and orphans. I notice what happens with the aliens living among you. I just want to make sure you see that as you go by. Chapter 23, verse 6, 7, and 8 echoes that. It talks again about protection for the poor. See, there's one more thing, and I think I've got just enough time to do this. The last little bit, which is actually 10 or 15 verses, starting in verse 20, God begins to talk to Moses about what's going to happen when they actually enter the promised land. He begins in verse 20 of chapter 23 by saying, look, I'm sending an angel to precede you, to guard you as you go, and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. Do what he says. Don't defy him, for my name is in him. The last little bit of verse 21, for my name is in him. Come down to verse 24. Verse 23 is rough, because it implies at the very least pushing a people out of the land that they used to live in to make room, and pushing them out totally. And if you come to another place nearby, yeah, I think it's that still verse 23. The last word in that is the word exterminate, which implies genocide. I don't fully understand that. I don't understand that at all. But I do have something to say about it. I'm sorry, that's what you get. If you have cancer and they do surgery for that cancer, what do you hope you hear from the doctor when the surgery is over? That they got it all. What if they don't get it all? What if they leave some of it behind? you are at great risk of that recurring. That's the only analogy I've ever heard that makes some kind of sense. It's still genocide. It's still pushing people off of land that they used to own. But listen carefully. God says, I'm going to push them all out. You're going to, none of them will be left. And the reason for that is down at the end, verse 33, somewhere down there. Let's start at verse 31. I think that'll catch the right verse. Your frontiers I will fix, and it names where they're going to be. I will put the inhabitants of that territory at your mercy, and you will drive them out before you. You will make no pact or treaty with them or with their gods. They may not stay in your country, or they might make you sin against me, for you would then serve their gods, and that would be a snare for you.
Well, I mean, look at it. You know, they can see heaven, and they still sin. So the God knows that with very little provocation, we as humans will jump right back into it.
And again, that's the only rationale that I can give, is that somehow we're getting a picture here of spiritual cancer. And the way to fix that is get it all. Okay? So what was the last injunction? No pact or treaty with them, right?
Right.
Okay, go to Joshua 9. We've got about 1 minute, maybe 2 minutes to do this. Go to Joshua chapter 9. We're in Exodus. We've got Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, about four books ahead. Go to Joshua chapter 9. Joshua chapter 9, the people of Israel have come across the Jordan River on dry land, no less. They have destroyed Jericho by marching around the city with a choir seven times and then shouting once. The walls fell down. Jericho was routed. The king of Ai has been defeated and his people have taken rout. What do all the other countries nearby think? All the other people groups that are the ones that the Israel people are now being aimed at. What do they think? Okay. This is all going to happen to us. So what do? Chapter 9 of Joshua, verse 1 and 2. They form a massive alliance, which probably they never would have formed again in their lives. They form a massive alliance to fight back. Except one people group does something different. Verse 3. When the inhabitants of Gibeon learned how Joshua had treated Jericho and Ai, for their part, they had recourse to a ruse. That's my translation. What does yours say right there?
Ruse.
Does it say ruse? It's not rose. This is ruse. What does the word ruse mean?
Deception.
Deception, trickery, right? Now, here's what they did. They took the moldiest bread that they could find. They took clothes that were so ragged, nobody would ever want to be caught dead in them. And they dressed themselves in these clothes and they carried this bread and they crossed this one little range of hills because that's how far away they were. And they came to the people of Israel and to Joshua and they said, look at our clothes. We have come from a long way away. These clothes were new when we left home. Look at our bread. It was warm when we left home. We've come from long away and we've heard about all the things that are happening. Make a treaty with us. Make a treaty with us. What was the injunction? Don't make a treaty. What are they about to do? Make a treaty. And here's what I want you to see. Joshua 9, verse 14. The leaders sampled some of the food they offered. But what? They did not consult with the Lord. They did not ask for the Lord's orders. Joshua made peace with them. He struck a treaty with them, guaranteeing their lives. And the leaders of the community, there's the elders again, ratified it by oath. And that became a thorn in their side for the rest of their existence in that place. Don't make a pact with them. Don't make a treaty with them. Because if you do, you've given a foothold. It's cancer. You need to get it out. Don't make a pact with them. Here they are making a pact with them. Okay? Now, that's all I have time for this morning. What are we going to do when we come back together next week? We're going to very quickly remember the overarching story. God speaks. The people quake in fear. Moses, you go talk to God. Moses has two conversations, in between which is this interlude in which the leaders themselves see God and the people agree in a covenant. They agree and affirm that agreement to obey everything. We're going to look at the second conversation, and then we're going to go take a look at all the consequences over in chapter 32. Okay? This is the first week in 7 months that we've done more than one chapter in a morning. This is pretty good. This is pretty good. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, sometimes you open our eyes to spiritual truth, but somehow the world puts the shutters and the blinders back on, and we forget what we've seen. Help us remember. Help us remember those high moments when we've been with you and you've allowed us to see spiritual truth. Help us not forget. Help us be like Elisha. Help us not be like Gehazi. Help us be people who remember who you are, remember what you've shown us, and not people who let the allure of what the world offers blind us to the spiritual truth you've revealed. Go with us through this week to come. Make us your faithful servants, for we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.